to make this tangible for the people around us as well. Help us to see how this can be put into practice. We ask for the sake of your Son, for his glory in our lives. Amen. So the last thing that is, I do not set apart the grace of God, or I don't set aside, nullify, you could say, the grace of God. For if through the law is righteousness, then Christ for nothing died. So there's some deep theology there, and we can spend all day just on something like that. So for if righteousness came through the law, Christ died for nothing. You've got a lot of questions there as far as what does righteousness mean at that point? Like, and again, it's difficult because we have the same word for justice here. And so it's something where we can have a tendency to think of righteousness as sort of this thing that I possess, this kind of righteous something that's there. And that could be valid. But at the same time, it could also be, this could be referring to God's justice. And it's not super clear. So
does he not make the distinction between the two, because he kind of wants that thing, like righteousness and justice, to be there? Or is it...
That's just the way the Greek language works. You just don't have, conceptually, you don't have a strong, you could say, distinction between those two things. And so there is, so the word here is dikaiosune, and that's Paul uses this word all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll have this is, again, righteousness, justice. If you wanted something that's more towards the justice side, like kind of like judgment, you could use krisis. And so when Jesus says you've neglected the weightier matters of the law, one of the three things that he says we usually translate into English as justice, but it's actually krisis, which is usually judgment, which you can say, I don't know. Like, I think that, you know, justice works okay, you know, as a translation, but the most straightforward translation would be judgment there. So there's other words that can be used if you want to, like, have more, I guess, an emphasis towards that side. There's also on the other side, if you wanted to have something that's more like a virtue, you know, there's other words that are there for that as well. So we have, for if through the law, again, I think it's helpful here to say Torah. So, for if through the Torah is righteousness, or justice, however you want to say it, then Christ for nothing died. I think that what is an example of is that he sees Christ as having some sort of function that just basically changes the whole game. The whole game under the law is one thing, but with Christ's death in particular... If you want to locate sort of where he looks at the crux of this whole thing, it's not necessarily just the resurrection he's talking about here, or Christ's life. It's really his crucifixion, his death, and he looks at as being this thing that sets into motion this whole new game plan, this whole new time. So he's just got finished talking with Peter. Peter's not necessarily saying, but I think Peter, in trying to keep the unity of the church, is saying, look, there's some people for whom me meeting with the Gentiles is a really, really big deal. I think it's fair maybe even to assume that they're Jewish Christians. It's not just like Jews who are like, you know, terrible people. It could be. I say terrible people as if every non-Christian is a terrible person, which isn't what I meant to say. So strike that from the tape. That was good, thanks.
Take that and start a whole new religion.
Yeah, there you go. Have fun with that. Maybe send me some royalties.
Theaters unite.
Some
royalties.
Yeah, send me some
royalties.
So it could be Jewish Christians that are objecting to this, and if they were, I think that you could understand, considering the framework that they're coming from, and like how it's like there's hard to find something that's more central than protecting, you know, the purity of the Jewish nation, because it's God's nation, it's God's people. And so they could be like, dude, like, what's going on? This is all crazy. This is all happening too fast. This is the Jews and Gentiles at the same table. And so Peter, wanting to keep unity, is like, okay, well, like, I'll withdraw and we'll figure this out. And Paul, I mean, as you've seen here, Paul gets real chipped off because he says, no, those distinctions in this time now isn't what matters. If you look at what the promises don't say that the whole world's going to become Jewish. It says that God's going to bless all the nations. When these promises to our forefathers come true, these promises have come true with the death of Christ. This is it. This is like the new period has started, and so we have to act in accordance with those. We can't. It's like you can almost say it's like, you know, like it's almost like when daylight savings times happened. It's a different time, and you can say that Peter is acting as though it's supposed to be 9 o'clock right now, and Peter's like, well, you know, let's just act like it's 8 o'clock for a while, and act like, you know, because not everybody has really switched over yet. We'll maybe do like sort of a gradual thing here and kind of get everybody sort of up to speed. And Paul's like, nope, it's 9 o'clock, and so we need to act in accordance with that. It's 9 o'clock right now, and if people need to get on board with that, then they can do it. But us saying it's 8:30 isn't going to help a whole lot. So I don't know if that analogy works at all.
Yeah, no, that works well. It's like ending modern day racism.
Yeah, no, there's, again, there's...
It's like integration, almost. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, whoa.
Well, it's interesting because that's the thing that happens in the early church, is you see this integration of races in a way that you don't really see it prior to this. Even using language like racism, we use that in a pejorative sense now, like, hey, to be racist is a bad thing. Well, for them, racism is a really big deal. And there's some that are, you know, if you're a Roman, for instance, Romans are the best race. Like, as a race, it's like, this is clearly a superior thing. There's other ones, you know, that accord some respect, and so...
Matt, are you Roman?
No, I'm not.
You look really Roman, so...
Thanks. I think, I don't know, I'm the one I am. I'm a Met of all kinds. So there is, so they have respect for the Egyptians, for instance, because the Egyptians have a culture that goes really way back. They have huge respect for old things, and so the Egyptians, you know, they're not Roman, but they're okay. Sort of after that, they have respect for the Greeks. They think the Greeks are too effeminate. Like, they think that they're duplicitous, and they think they're effeminate, but they have respect for their older culture. They just say, yeah, their culture was really great back in the day, you just don't really see it. The Greeks that are around these days just don't really embody that, and so, whatevs. We guess they're okay. And then after that, it just... Yeah, and then after that, it's just kind of like, it's just sort of lame. Like, the rest of the races are sort of weird. You don't have this sense of... I mean, if you're looking at our contemporary culture, you know, you see this very large thing against racism. It's like, hey, no, you can't say one race is better than the other.
Is this the view of everyone, or is this, like, through Roman eyes?
No, this is the view of everybody.
Really?
This is the view of everybody, which makes sense. And it's interesting, where do you see the genesis of almost what we take as a normative value today? Yeah. Well, Genesis is with early Christianity. It's because of what Paul is. I mean, you point back to Galatians and say, how do we get from that ancient world to getting where we are right now, where racism is like pretty much universally accepted, at least around these parts, as like, hey, no, that's bad, and you should treat all races as if they're equal. Get from this guy. It really is, and it's the outworking of that, and the world is transformed by it, because there's a real sense in which this, I think what Paul is putting forth here is that this is the new humanity that God's promised. This is new creation. That's, you know, I think in Romans 6 he says, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision is anything but new creation. So he says, look, Jew doesn't matter, Gentile doesn't matter. What matters is new creation. That's the category that matters. So that's what we're after. And so because of that, you end up getting to over 2,000 years to where we're at today, which is sweet. I think it's really good. The difficulty is when, as a culture, we want to take those values as being normative in a way that separates it from the root, because after a while, I think what we're going to find is that when you don't have a root for some kind of value, it's fairly easy to get rid of under pressure. And so, I mean, an example of something like this is, you know, is in 20th century Germany. They, as far as their Christianity goes, it had lost a lot of roots. Kind of that liberal Protestantism had deconstructed, you could say, what Christianity was. And so it essentially became an official arm of the state. And then after being divorced from its actual roots, you can say after being divorced from the great tradition that's behind it and just becoming this arm of the state, it's very easy to start doing a lot of things that wouldn't accord with what traditional Christianity would say is okay and not okay. And so when the pressure comes, you know, the church by and large in Germany buckled. You have
folks like Bonhoeffer.
You have lots of exceptions. Those are exceptions to the rule, not the rule itself. The German church, by and large, you know, capitulated because it had become an arm of the state. So it's one of the difficulties. If you want to trace this all the way back, you can go and say, in 1517, I think this actually happens more in 1521. In 1517, Luther goes and says. We'll say 1521, around there, that period. Luther says, nope, head of the church isn't the Pope anymore. Like, we're not doing that. Head of the church is civil magistrate. So whoever is the person that's in charge in a particular country, that's the person that's going to be the head of the church.
Did he really?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is you have to have a head somewhere. You have to have something that's sort of your principle for unity. And so Luther says, nope, it's not the Pope. It's going to be these German princes. And these German princes are like, sweet, because we're sick of paying taxes over to Italy. Like, we think that's lame. We're not really that interested in building a basilica over there. We hear it's going to be really nice. We don't really care, because we're not there. We're over here in Germany. And so we're going to protect you. So that's, I mean, there's a sense in which that's kind of where, whereas other, you can say... In one sense, you can say reform movements, but even that is maybe not super accurate. You can say other breakaway reform movements prior to Luther, don't have success because they don't have support from the civil magistrates. What happens with Luther is that the German princes go, and this is really the thing, the German princes go and say, you know what, we're standing with you against the Pope, against his power, because we're really sick of paying taxes over there. And so we're just going to pay taxes to ourselves. It's going to be way more fun. And so Luther's protected. And so that's really the firm divide. And then what you see, what happens, you know, over time, because essentially the state is the, you know, the civil magistrate, whoever the leader in the German, whatever principality you're in, is the one who says what goes and what doesn't go from a religious perspective. When you get to the 20th century, and the civil magistrates, you know, are Nazis, then you have, you're in some trouble there. Now, I don't want to go and say, I don't want to act as though there's super easy answers here. Because clearly, if you look at what's going on in the late medieval Catholic Church, there's some very serious problems there, which I think, you know, even they at the time recognized that there's very serious problems that were going on. And so just, you know, just like having a pope doesn't make everything kind of nice and tidy and easy and, you know, simple and fun. There's difficulties in, you know, and all kinds of different, you know, sort of authority approaches that you can have. But you can also see where that goes by having the magistrates be the ones that say, how's that goes. How do we get to that? There was something right before it. How do we get to it?
Talking about the law.
I want the law, but what was it? How do we get to...
Civil magistrate?
Yeah, how do we get to...
We're talking about...
Oh, okay. This is what it was. It was, what do we do when sort of the you know, because, you know, around us, by and large, racism, for example, is something where, you know, we have this Christianized idea of racism is lame, and so don't do it. But you can see roots in right here. If you just want to look on a history of ideas kind of perspective, this is ultimately what does it. There's other people that say similar things, you know, at various points. This is the thing that actually has traction. This is the thing that actually changes the culture. So what do you do when you actually take the heart of Christianity out of it? The question is, under pressure, how long will those values stand still? And if you look in 20th century Germany, the answer is not an extremely long time. Those values don't really last like that. Here's another fun can of worms. The thing with the Penn State football coach?
Yeah.
Jerry Sandusky?
Yeah.
From our perspective, super gnarly stuff.
Yeah.
Super, super, super gnarly. I think an interesting question would be to say, why is that super, super, super gnarly? Now that might seem like a really silly question.
Quick rundown, what happened with him?
He basically had really, gross relationships with a bunch of little boys. So, from our perspective, we have, it seems like the most obvious thing in the world, kind of in a way like racism, where it's like, it just seems super obvious that this is like not okay. I think an interesting thing to do would be to see if somebody from the ancient world, so say somebody from somewhere in Greece, circa 200 BC, was around, and they were seeing this whole thing. I think that they'd be very confused. Because relationships like this between older men and younger boys were very, very commonplace. And so...
Really?
Yeah.
Sketchy.
To us, it seems super sketch. And granted...
Glad I don't live in Greece.
Granted, it wasn't... It didn't meet with the same kind of approval, you can say. It didn't meet with the same kind of approval outside of kind of that Hellenistic culture.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, my understanding is that the Romans were like less down with that, and just less down with homosexuality in general. Whereas, Hellenistic culture, the Greek culture, can be pretty, pretty, pretty open to it. And so that was really common. And if you would have said, "Hey, that's wrong," they would have said, "Dude, like, this is our culture. Like, get off our backs. This is how we do it. Who are you to judge us? Like, what standard for judging us are you guys coming out with? What universal standard for, hey, this is right and this is wrong, are you guys saying? Is, I guess, has to be, because in our books, this is how it's done. This is kind of part of the maturing process for younger boys. Just this is the way it works. And so I think it'd be really interesting to have a conversation if we wanted to say at the end of the day, it's like, hey, this is our sure foundation for why this is so wrong. It's difficult to avoid theological categories. It's like, at the end of the day, if you ask somebody, why are all human beings created equal? Like, because just using our own reason, we might not say that. There might be people that would question that. We might say, no, that person looks like they have more value than that person over there. So why would we say that? You'd end up quoting the Declaration of Independence, evidently, you say, because they're endowed by these inalienable rights by their creator or whatever. But even in quoting that, you're invoking theological categories. There's a specific theological tradition that you're saying. You're pulling on the Christian tradition from that, saying, no, the creator has given these things. There's somebody who made each individual person, and didn't just make them, but made them all equal. So I think in any kind of conversation like this, it's what we want to do is we want to put theology in a box and say, hey, look, theology, why don't you go live in this box over here? So we'll do our politics, we'll do our other stuff over here, and we'll kind of go along. And if we want to open that theology box someday, then we'll do it. Chances are we won't, but maybe at some point, yeah, at least we know that you're present. Just to be honest, I'm much more comfortable with something like that. I think we're all much more comfortable with something like that. The thing is, it doesn't work. The thing is, it's sort of like a hide the ball game where you kind of put the hot ball and then you sort of hide, like, oh, this isn't, it's real, it's just right here. It's just under like a cup or something like that. It's like, theology just doesn't go anywhere. The idea of there being something that's, purely secular, or us having a purely secular government, is really goofy if you read the beginning of the Declaration of Independence. It's just not... It it's not there. You have it's certainly you can say a watered down form of Christianity. It's something where it's essentially deistic Christianity. It's not it's which is, you know, kind of in the 18th century at that point, that's what's popular. It's kind of what's going around. It's kind of deistic intellectual Christianity. But it's still Christianity. And so it gets hard when we want to go and we want to we want to sort of share our values on a universal scale. When we want to go to China and say, hey, you need to go and you need to start educating your women. And if there's a woman child, like if there's a woman baby and you don't want it, you can't kill it. Like you have to raise it. And you need to start treating them better. Because these are universal values. The Chinese at that point say, who the heck made you guys the judge of us? They kind of pull the Greek card the same way the Greeks would say, who are you to, like, who are you to judge our culture? We, the Chinese at that point would say, wait a second, we're curious. At what point did we appoint you judges over us? At what point did we appoint you judges over our culture? And maybe you could tell us where you're getting these universal values from. Because in our tradition, where we come from, males are more valued than females. And so maybe you could tell us where you got your ideas from. And, you know, there would be a pause, and there'd be some shuffling, and maybe with some rustling of books. And eventually you'd end up pointing to, probably to Galatians 3:28. There's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, because you're all one in Christ Jesus. It might take a long time to get to that point. But it's like, if you want to see what actually got us to the point where we are as far as values goes, it's not just unimpeded human reason, because the Chinese are quite a rational people. You might have taken an exam next to one of them. They tend to be pretty bright. They're pretty rational. It's not just this kind of pure unaided reason that gets us there. It's a reason that's influenced and informed by revelation when it comes down to it. So anyway, it's kind of, you know, all this goes to say, it's like, we have these values, we take what's here in Galatians, and we look at this from a, you know, if we say racism, that Paul's fighting against racism, we can make sense of that. The question is, how, to what degree in the long term, if we want to completely bracket theology out of this, out of any kind of, you know, as a culture, if we want to bracket these things out of the equations, how long will we actually be able to go and stand up against something like racism? Because eventually somebody's going to start asking hard questions and making hard statements. And if you don't have a backing for why racism is wrong, it can be something where you find yourself in a situation like the church in Germany in the 20th century. And they're just one example. There's plenty of others. Does that stuff make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a little warm up.
Warm up to the other sessions. Really glad I don't live in Greece. At least in the 15th century, where you get.
Where are you going?
I'm gonna wash my hands.
Okay.